We began the first week by discussing the idea of the big story, the challenges that any big story faces in our contemporary culture, and the way in which the big story of Scripture serves as the structure for the entire canon of Scripture. In our second week, we focused on the opening chapter of God's big story, the creation of all that is. And in our third week, we covered the second major plot move in the biblical storyline, the rebellion of mankind, and the way in which that rebellion wrought so much devastation in God's beautiful creation, yet without altering in the least God's good plans for glorifying himself through that creation. Last week, we took a whirlwind tour through the life of Abraham and the promises that God made to him. Last week, we took a whirlwind tour through the life of Abraham and the promises that God made to him. And if you were here last week, it was a little bit of a whirlwind trying to get through all of those details. Especially, I felt bad for the fact that we had an interpreter here last week. And so I felt very bad for the poor interpreter trying to sign all of this stuff about all of these details and talking about Hebrew and all that kind of stuff. And yet, because those promises are so foundational to all that follows in the big story of the Bible as a whole, my original plan had been to move on to Exodus tonight, but because we covered so much that was so foundational and left out so much that was also important, then I decided tonight we're going to do a recap of the story of Abraham. So we went into a lot of details about the specific structure of God's commands to Abraham and God's promises to Abraham. And yet, this course isn't about the structure of Genesis or the structure of particular passages, but about the big story. And so I want to kind of do a recap of the details that we covered, showing how those details tie into the big picture. So kind of zooming out a little bit, and then we also did not get the opportunity to talk about the patriarchs, the remainder of Genesis from chapter 22 onwards. We did not discuss that, and I don't want to skip that because I think there's a lot of stories that can be puzzling as to why they're even in Scripture, or can be misunderstood, or if they misunderstood why they are, that I think if we tie them into the big picture, then we'll get a better understanding of why they're in the canon to begin with. And so I think that's valuable, and we're going to go back and pick that up tonight. I will be out of town next week, and then I'll have just gotten back into town the week after that, and so I will not be teaching the next 2 weeks, and then either the next week or the week after that, I'll pick up the Exodus account, and then that will be the end of my segment of teaching, and then we'll see exactly the way that that's all going to work with Christmas. We'll see how that goes. But for now, we're going to return to the life of Abraham. Now, the story of Abraham, as I mentioned last week, is absolutely foundational to everything that follows. Indeed, there is a very real sense in which after Abraham, there are no more new starts for humanity, only continual expansions upon and fulfillments of the promises originally given to Abraham in 12:1-3, and that's something we'll see. And that may sound surprising, but if you look at the way that Scripture interprets Scripture going forwards, I think you'll see that that will be in fact the case, and we'll see that as we move forward in the course over the next several weeks. Now, I'm not going to go over, as I mentioned, all the details we covered last week, because then we would be here spending as long on that as we did last week, which was already too long last week. So I don't want to repeat that mistake again, because it got to be pretty long, even going way too fast. But we went over so many details, and I don't want us to miss the big picture, and I think I actually already said that. So, going back to Genesis 3, the curse that God placed on humanity was threefold. There was a rending of the covenant relationship of God with humanity. No longer could they dwell in his presence. And that's really what Eden was the presence of God dwelling with his people. As one person has put it, if I can remember this right, because it's not in my notes, God's people dwelling under God's rule in God's presence is really what the kingdom of God is about. And you found that in Eden, that Eden was a place where God's presence was there, God's people was there, God's people were there, and they were living under God's rule. And what happened when they chose to rebel, they could no longer live in God's presence. So they were exiled from the presence of God. Not that God could no longer see them, but from that covenant presence of God's relationship with his people, that was broken. There was a curse upon descendants. Being fruitful and multiplying was still God's plan, but it would no longer be easy, and it would be attended with much pain, sorrow, and heartache. So not only would God's people struggle to relate to him, they would struggle to be a people at all and not to die out. So that would be the second aspect of the curse. And the third aspect was there was a curse upon the dominion that man had been given over the ground. No longer would labor be easy and joyous as it had been intended to be. Work was part of God's original plan, but work and the pain and suffering that comes along with it today is a complication of that original plan. So mankind was always intended to work for God, but that work was not intended to be a burden and a cause of suffering and pain. Henceforth, mankind would earn his bread by the sweat of his brow and would contend against the continual opposition of thorns and thistles and all of the rest. Now, of course, I want to be quite clear that I'm not saying there is something cursed about having descendants or something cursed about work, and really we'd be better off if we didn't have descendants and we didn't work, because if you remember, the first aspect of that was that our relationship with God was broken, and certainly I don't think anyone would suggest there's something wrong with relating to God. So these are all things. The fact that the rebellion of humanity affected all three of these areas doesn't at all mean that these are bad things. On the contrary, imaging God, being fruitful and taking dominion, is the job description that God gave to mankind in the first place. This is what we're here to do. It's just what we're here to do got a lot more complicated when mankind in Adam chose to rebel against God. And yet from that, and that job description remained in place. So God gave, when things started over with Noah, Noah was given exactly the same task to be in relationship with God, to be fruitful and multiply, and to take dominion over the earth. God's plan for humanity didn't change, even when humanity complicated the execution of that plan. The story of Noah, so that is the beginning, the creation of all that is, and God had those purposes, and yet mankind's rebellion complicated the fulfillment of those purposes. And the story of Noah, who received a commission identical to the commission of Adam. So Noah is very well seen as a second type of Adam. The problem was, as Kevin DeYoung winsomely points out, Noah was just too much like the first Adam. And Noah demonstrated that if things were going to be put to rights, mankind was going to need more than just a fresh start and a new environment. The problem went deeper than that. Something more was going to be needed. After each of the episodes of rebellion in Genesis 1 to 11, the initial rebellion of humanity, Cain and Abel coming next, and then the destruction that resulted in the flood. After each of those episodes, there is a mitigating word of grace from God. Even as he judged them, God mitigated his judgment. And there isn't a precise formula like here's this and then here's this specific formula for God's grace. But you find that. And every time mankind rebels, then God is speaking a word of grace or mitigation. Even when Cain kills Abel, God puts a mark on Cain so that the cycle of murder would cease and not spread. The mark of Cain was a mitigation of Cain's punishment. It actually wasn't his punishment. It was something to keep the punishment from growing larger. So the mark of Cain, if anyone wants to speculate about that, was a mark of God's grace, not of his curse. Now, of course, Cain was cursed, but it was a mitigation of God's curse, not the actual evidence of it. And a lot of people go very strange places with that, but that's not what's going on in the text. And that's also not what's going on in my notes, to which we now need to return. After each of the episodes of rebellion, there was a mitigating word of grace from God. And yet, after the Tower of Babel in chapter 11, there was no immediate word of grace from God. There was a judgment, and there was no apparent word of grace to that judgment, to correspond to that judgment. And that raised the question, as I mentioned last week, quoting someone else, is God's grace now over? Is there no word of grace to the nations? Well, God was not done dealing with the problem of human rebellion. In fact, he was about to set in motion the plan he had in mind all along, and that plan started with the call of Abram, who came to be known as Abraham. And yet, even though Abram was, if you look at the context and you look at the way that Genesis 1 through 11:26, which is that first section of Genesis, is structured, then it's clear that even at the macro structure of the text, Abraham is God's word of grace to the Tower of Babel. And yet Abraham was more than God's word of grace to the specific rebellion that took place at Babel. I mentioned this last week. Abraham, though no one could ever have guessed it at the time, or indeed for some time afterwards, was the human foundation of God's plan to deal with the rebellion of mankind as a whole. There have been five repetitions of the Hebrew word for curse in Genesis 1 through 11:26, and in the initial call of Abraham, there's a fivefold repetition of the word for blessing. Not only that, but the commands that God had given to Adam and then repeated to Noah, commands to be fruitful and to take dominion, those commands were now promises to Abraham. God would see to it that his purposes for humanity would be accomplished, even though humanity had demonstrated that they were incapable of fulfilling those purposes. Of course, these promises to Abraham didn't come without commands of their own. So it wasn't like God said, all right, I'm done giving commands, now I'm just going to give you a bunch of promises. God came and he said, now what I gave as commands before, I'm going to make sure that they get accomplished, but there are still tasks for you to perform. And God initially came to Abraham in chapter 12, 1 through 3. His speech had a particular structure, and that structure is important for understanding the way that the story of Abraham as a whole plays out. There were two commands, to each of which was attached three blessings. The first command was to go with a threefold promise that God would make of him a great nation, bless him, and make his name great. And the second command was to be a blessing, and that was a command. Go and then be a blessing. It's an imperative form of the verb, and it was a command, and there was a threefold promise attached to that command, and that threefold promise was that God would bless the one that blessed Abraham, curse the one that cursed him, and most importantly, that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. The promises attached to the commands were continually expanded and enlarged throughout the story of Abraham, but the commands remained more or less the same. And Abraham's persistent failure, almost to the end of his life, to carry out the second to be a blessing. So Abraham was he obeyed the command to go, so he obeyed that one. But he didn't obey the command to be a blessing until the end of his life. And the work that God did in Abraham's heart and on his life to bring him to the point where he would be concerned not just about receiving a blessing, but about being a blessing, drives much of the remainder of the story, as we talked about last week. God came to him in chapter 12 with a word of promise and command, and Abram at least partly obeyed. By chapter 15, a good deal of time had passed, and it didn't look to Abram like God was going to fulfill his promises any better than Abram had obeyed the commands, which is to say, not very well at all. So God gave him a covenant, and this is in chapter 15, to demonstrate in the strongest way possible that God was faithful, even when Abram wasn't. Abram still didn't fully trust God, and so he tried in chapter 16 in the famous story of Hagar and Ishmael to fulfill God's promises for him. And God came back in chapter 17 with the reiteration of the promises and the double reminder of a name change and circumcision that even though God's faithfulness was not dependent on Abram's, it was not to exist without it either. In chapters 18 and 19, and that's the story of how Abram interceded for Sodom and for Lot, Abraham finally, now called Abraham, that was his name change, and I think I'm not the only one to get that mixed up when you're trying to tell the whole story. He begins to learn the lesson that God has been trying to teach him, and then in chapter 20, he reverts back to the dishonest self-protection that had characterized him from the beginning and lying about his wife once again. God still, in chapter 21, gives him the son he had promised, but then in chapter 22, and that's the story of Abraham and Isaac on the Mount Moriah, God dealt once again with Abraham's failure, giving him a final opportunity to develop through obedience the life of faith that God had always intended for him. And he passed that test. God wanted Abraham to develop a faith in God that was greater than the evidence that Abraham could see of God's faithfulness. And in the end, though the circumstances were shocking, that is exactly what happened. God made a lot of promises to Abraham. And then we spent a great deal of time last week on the details, and I just gave just a brief summary of what we spent almost an hour on last week. We spent a great deal of time on those details. We would not be able to really cover them all in detail if we took 15 weeks just to talk about the life of Abraham. Easily, it's been done many times. You could spend 15 weeks of teaching on just Abraham. And I'm sure we could do that, but we're not going to do that because the focus is on not getting too bogged down in the details, but to see the big picture. And so if you look at the big picture, if you take all the promises that God made to Abraham, and then you look at the way those promises get restated later on in the story of Genesis, you could sum up all of God's promises to Abraham under four heads, four main heads. God promised Abraham a seed. God promised he would bring that seed and keep that seed in a covenant relationship with him. And God promised he would give that seed the land of promise. So even though the details are expanded and they're expounded upon in various different ways, those three of the four that I'm going to mention, those three promises are basically what the promises boil down to. And if you think about it, those three promises are each a direct response to the three curses that we have in Genesis chapter 3. There's a curse on the relationship. The relationship between God and humanity is broken. So the covenant between Adam and Eve and their creator was violated and broken. There was a curse on the land, and there was a curse on descendants. And God is giving promises to address each of those three curses. And yet, there's a fourth element here that is under the surface most of the time. But the fact that it is under the surface doesn't mean it is any the less important, because it is, in fact, foundational. And that fourth is that God promised that through the fulfillment of the first three promises, somehow, someday, all the nations of the world would be blessed. In other words, though this is far from explicit for the majority of the narrative, this fourth promise goes back to the basic twofold structure of God's word to Abraham, the twofold structure of two commands with three promises attached to each command. God did not just promise to bless Abram and his family because God thought they were such a wonderful family and decided to like them better than anyone else. That was never the point. The point was that God's choice of Abraham was his word of grace, and his work of grace, to the rebellion of the nations, indeed to the rebellion of humanity, indeed to the problem of sin itself. It would be a long time coming, and when it came, it would come in a way that was both paradoxical and shocking to everyone who saw it, but there would come a day when the fulfillment of the first three promises would indeed result in the fulfillment of the fourth. But to explain how that happened would be to skip to the very end of our story, something that I keep saying I'm not going to do but end up doing anyways. To return to where we are in the story, after the grand narrative of God's dealing with Abraham. So, you know, you look at Genesis chapter 12 or the covenant in Genesis 15 or the reiteration of the covenant in Genesis chapter 17 or the story of Abraham's faithfulness by that point on Mount Moriah with Isaac. You're talking about big, majestic stories. Now, there's some non-majestic stories in Abraham's life too, but if you just focus on the high points, it's pretty amazing what God does with Abraham. The rest of Genesis can seem pretty anticlimactic, honestly. I mean, at least until you get to Joseph, if you start looking at what happened to Isaac and Jacob and Esau and Judah, what are we to make of such strange stories as Genesis 38, and this is the story of Judah and Tamar, or even 34, the rape of Dinah and the deceitful and unjust retaliation slaughtering a whole city by Levi and Simeon, which is honestly hardly any better. And even though the story of Joseph is certainly beautiful, so people wonder, I would imagine that many people have wondered, at least I have at times past, why in the world is Genesis 38, that's Judah and Tamar, why is that in Genesis? I mean, these narratives span dozens and dozens of years and multiple generations. Surely other things happened that could have been included instead of that. So it obviously is there for a reason, not just because they're giving everything that happened and that just happened to be one of the less pleasant things that happened. There's a reason why it's included, and yet that reason is maybe not as much on the surface. And even though the story of Joseph is beautiful and everyone loves the story of Joseph, at least everyone I know loves the story of Joseph, when you start to think about it, how does the story of Joseph connect to the story of Abraham? So Is it just a random collection of stories? If it's a random collection of stories, who would ever collect those kind of stories and put them all together? And if it's telling a single story, then the ones that make the most sense as to why they would be in a random collection of stories seem like they fit the least in the narrative that is there. Does that make sense, the dilemma that I'm posing a little bit? Everyone, you get what I'm getting at? And the answer to these questions, so the answer to these challenges, like why are these stories included? And then the ones that we would think are obvious they would be included, what do they have to do with the story as a whole? The answer to those two questions is found in the way that the three foundational promises we just mentioned serve to structure the Pentateuch as a whole. So I said there's four promises that drive the narrative. There's three that are on the surface and in the structure. And underneath that structure, there's always the fact that the purpose of those three promises is to fulfill the fourth. But that isn't actually driving the structure of the Pentateuch as a whole. The remainder of Genesis deals with how, against all odds and against every kind of opposition, God preserved a seed for Abraham. Exodus and Leviticus deal with how God brought this people into a covenant relationship with him, and Numbers and Deuteronomy deal with how God brought them to the borders of the land of promise. And this is a simplification, of course, particularly the way that I'm characterizing Exodus and Leviticus, and they don't necessarily break at the chapter divisions precisely. But those three promises undergird. So if you take the Pentateuch as a whole, and I've mentioned this before, Genesis 1 to 11 tell the story of how the world got to a point where God's purposes for creation began to be fulfilled through promises to a particular nation in that creation. And then the remainder of the Pentateuch, the remainder of Genesis, tells about the promise of a seed, and then it moves in Exodus. By the time you get to the book of Exodus, and we'll talk about this when we talk about Exodus next week, but this is something, it's not original to me, of course, but it's a way of looking at the Pentateuch that when you see this, you can't unsee it because it makes so much sense of everything that is going on. And basically, by the time you get to Exodus, then the promise of a seed has been fulfilled. They're abundant, but they're not in a covenant relationship with God, and they're not in a land of their own. And they're not being a blessing to anyone, by the way, either. And so when you get to the beginning of Exodus, then Exodus, they're brought out so that they can serve God. So there's a wordplay in the beginning of Exodus, and there's a wordplay in the beginning of Exodus between serving Pharaoh and serving God, and worshiping God. The same word is used for both of those. They're not to serve Pharaoh, they're to serve God. And it's the same word that's used for serve and worship, and there's a deliberate playing off against. They're servants of Pharaoh, they're supposed to be servants of God. And all of the regulations that you find in Exodus and Leviticus, they're all about this one thing. How can God's people dwell in his presence again? After all the sin and all the rebellion. And that is what Exodus and Leviticus are about. And then, as you know, notice the book of Numbers is not just a book full of numbers, though it is that, but it's a book that begins and ends with censuses, or I think it's censuses of the military forces of the nation of Israel as they prepare to take over the promised land, even despite their rebellion and wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. And when you get to the book of Deuteronomy, the entirety of the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' speech to the children of Israel as they're about to cross over into the promised land, recapitulating everything that has taken place and preparing them to be given the promise of the land. And so that is how those three promises structure the entirety of the Pentateuch. Let's see. And of course, it's somewhat of a simplification, but I think it is a simplification that actually helps you to see, not impose a structure on the text, but see the structure that is under the text itself. And when we reread the remainder of the text of Genesis in this light, it is almost as though the selection of stories is being driven by a checklist of all the things that could possibly go wrong, all the obstacles that could possibly stand in the way of God's promise of a distinct seed of, as one author puts it, a continuous line of direct descendants from Abraham. That's what's going on. And that is why all those strange stories are in there. If we read the book of Genesis as primarily a book of examples, we're going to be left with a cherry-picking mentality that will still leave us scratching our head. So we can pick this story, pick this story, pick this story, skip this story, skip this story, and then we're wondering, why is this story interrupted? Why is this story I like interrupted by this story that I don't like? And maybe I should just kind of just like you know, throw Genesis away and rewrite it or something like that. And I know that sounds radical, but that's honestly what many Christians do with Genesis, is they throw Genesis away the way it's put together and put together something else that makes more sense to them. But that's not what I want to do, because that anything that I put together using the materials of Genesis and not understanding what Genesis is saying is not inspired. It's only as inspired as I am, which is to say, not very much at all. If we read the story as it was written, the story of how God preserved, against all odds, a seed to Abraham, the selection of stories begins to make more sense. What we need to remember is that the book of Genesis, like the Pentateuch as a whole, and many people believe this, in fact, it's one of the Genesis goes back to Moses, and we would believe that, but many people believe that without then drawing the conclusion that if Genesis was written by Moses, then it was addressed to the children of Israel and must be understood in that light. And it's the Pentateuch as a whole, including the book of Genesis, is addressed to the children of Israel sometime after the Exodus and before they entered the promised land. They, even as the later books of the Pentateuch record, they desperately needed to learn that God could be trusted in his promise of a land, even when it seemed as though the odds were insurmountable, and even and especially when the people to whom God had made those promises were anything but faithful. Seen in this light, the stories that initially left us scratching our heads begin to come together into a big picture that makes enormous sense and has very much to say to our lives today. We're certainly not going to be able to cover every detail in the next few minutes. We will turn to those stories, and I'll be referencing the chapter numbers so you can flip through as we go along, but I'm not going to be, there'll only be a few places where I read a verse, because if I try to read all the stories from Genesis 24 through 50, you might not stick here with me. So I'm not going to do that, or even if you do, you might not come back. So I'm just going to be going through the story and retelling it and relying to a certain extent on your knowledge of the biblical stories already, but showing the way they fit together. But if you flip through it, I may refer to things as we'll be just kind of going through chapter by chapter, so I may refer to some things as we go along, though I certainly won't be covering every detail. After Abraham's climactic test of faith in chapter 22, chapter 23 records the death and burial of Sarah. And the burial place that Abraham purchased from Ephron was the only concrete fulfillment of the promise of the land that Abraham was to see in his lifetime. So the only thing that Abraham ever owned in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan, was a tomb. But he did own that. But that didn't worry him too much, because he did have the promised son. And that's what Abraham wanted. He wanted a son. And God gave him a son to carry on the line in which one day all the promises would be fulfilled. Nevertheless, there was a problem. Moving on to chapter 24, Isaac was 40 years old, and he did not have a wife, which meant, of course, that he also did not have a son. Not only that, but there were no marital prospects for hundreds of miles around. Some people say they can't find anyone. How would you like to have no one you could marry for hundreds of miles around, regardless of whether they were to your liking or not? That was the case for Isaac. It gets worse. If Isaac left the land to go looking for a wife, the chances were that he wouldn't come back. There was just Isaac by himself. So here Isaac is. He's hundreds of miles away from a wife, and he's not supposed to travel and leave the land. Seems like God's promises are in a little bit of trouble. And this is the dynamic that is driving Genesis chapter 24. The point is not, as it was once expressed to me, that you shouldn't be in any hurry to get married because, after all, Isaac was 40 years old. That is put in a little bit of perspective by the fact that he did live to be 180, so if we take the average lifespan today, that would come out to something like 17, which would not also, the point is not you should get married at 17. It has nothing to do with his age. And the point is not also, again, someone actually tried to tell me this, that you should be completely passive in the issue of marriage, that men should not pursue after anyone, but that the perfect woman will come to them in God's perfect time and they don't need to do any work. That's not what the text is saying. The point was that Isaac needed a wife, and yet because of the commands of God to remain in the land, he couldn't go and get one. The fact that in those circumstances, he actually got a wife who enabled the promises of God to be carried on to the next generations was, considering the circumstances, almost as much of a miracle as his birth was to begin with. The point is not, this is therefore how you should go and find a wife, but under these unbelievably miraculous circumstances, God still provided a wife for Isaac. And that's what's going on in the story. Now, of course, marriage customs were somewhat different then, so some of the details may be due to that. But sending a servant hundreds of miles to a family you'd only had one piece of news from in the past 80 years or so, to send their daughter sight unseen to marry a husband sight unseen, has never been a normal cultural practice. This was unusual in their day, just as it would be highly unusual in our day. And the servant certainly didn't interpret it in that way. When Rebekah's family agreed to send her, he bowed his head and worshipped the Lord in thanks for his miraculous grace in convincing Rebekah's family to send her. Yet more miracles would be needed before God's promises would be fulfilled. Moving on to chapter 25, they're now married. Going to chapter 25 and verse 21. Rebekah, like her deceased mother-in-law Sarah, was barren. Though Isaac interceded for her, and this is something that I had not noticed, but I looked up a commentary on actually something unrelated to that, and it says, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife, and yet later on in the story, let's see, where is it? There we go. Verse 26. So verse 21 says, and Isaac entreated the Lord for, so verse 20, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to wife. Verse 21, Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And then in verse 26, at the end of verse 26, and Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. So if you didn't notice that, I had never noticed that, then you would think, okay, Isaac's 40 years old when he gets married, and his wife is barren, and he prays to the Lord, and then she has children. But what the reality is, that he waited 20 years before Isaac was born. Isaac was 60 when his son was born, and though Rebekah may have been younger, she was no spring chicken to be having her first children. This may not have been quite the miracle that God did for Abraham and Sarah. I doubt the comparison made the long years of waiting any easier for Isaac or Rebekah. Yet the struggle to conceive was nothing like the struggle that took place after conception. She became pregnant, and there was a great struggle in her womb, a struggle so great and so unusual that Rebekah became seriously concerned and inquired of the Lord, who responded with an oracle about two nations that at the time, because he didn't say you're going to have twins and their twins are going to become great nations, he just said about two nations being in your womb. So it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it made more sense as the years went on. So the oracle could only be described as cryptic, and some clarity was brought when she gave birth as she brought forth twin boys. The boys could hardly have been more different. And the proud parents picked favorites. Jacob loved Esau, but Rachel loved Jacob, which was hardly a promising start for the fulfillment of a promise of a great and unified nation. To make matters worse, Jacob took advantage of his minutes older brother, or perhaps he was an hour older, I don't know, but I'll say minutes older, and used Esau's appetite to steal his birthright, creating a permanent grudge once Esau's brains got out of his belly. When a famine came, God appeared to Isaac and warned him not to leave the land, promising to fulfill through Isaac the promises he'd made to Abraham all those years ago. Once again, God promised to be with Isaac, to give him a seed, to give that seed a land, and through the fulfillment of those promises to bless the nations of the earth. Like his father before him, Isaac seemed a lot more interested in the promises than in God's purpose in giving them. He stayed in the land, but he played the same nasty, sneaking trick on the people around him that Abraham had tried twice by denying that Rebekah was his wife. This time, though, God exposed his lie before it led to judgment for anyone else. Let's see, I think we're still in chapter 26. Move 26 here. This time, God came to him once again and again assured him that his promises would be fulfilled. That's at the end of chapter 26. Yet those promises, and this is the very end of 26, seem to be getting off to a rough start in the next generation. Esau decided to take for himself not just a wife, but wives from the Canaanites who surrounded them, raising once again the always present possibility that the seed that God had promised Abraham would become indistinguishable from the nations that surrounded them. And basically, those are the if you take the obstacles that appear over and over again, you have the obstacle that at the beginning you have the obstacle of barrenness. So perhaps they're not going to have children. And you have a remarkably high level of barren women in this family that this is the one that has been promised that they're going to have a seed, and yet they struggle to conceive. What's going on? There's a war going on here, and the war is, are they going to have children or not? So there's the war between the serpent and the woman that is spoken about in Genesis chapter 3, and this is how it's playing out. So the women in the family could be barren, and perhaps they wouldn't have children. Well, if they have children, perhaps those children will intermarry with the nations around them, and they'll become indistinguishable from everyone else. So that's a second obstacle. They're going to intermarry. They might marry the wrong people, and then they will blend in and no longer be a conduit through which descendants of Abraham can come. Or the third obstacle is that they could be, and indeed they were, just as rotten as everyone else. How could God fulfill his promises through such rotten people? He has a lot of work to do on that. And we see those three elements in and out, back and forth, all throughout the remainder of Genesis. So the first two were so that Sarah was barren, and then Isaac couldn't find a wife, and now Rebecca is barren. Well, Rebecca has children, but now Esau gets the game off on the wrong foot by intermarrying with the Canaanites around him, and not only that, but intermarrying with multiple Canaanites around him. And the last verse of 26, verse 35 says, "Which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah." Chapter 27 tells the story of how Jacob, with the help of his mother, deceived his father into giving him the blessing that belonged to his brother, in addition to the birthright he'd already tricked him into handing over. When Esau found out, he wanted to kill his brother, raising yet another possibility for the destruction of the promised seed. Esau was already mixing with the people around him. If he killed Jacob, then the end of the story would be at hand. He didn't, and it wasn't. Jacob, whose character up to this point hardly shows him in a very good light, was forced to flee for his life to the only place he could have found a wife, or as it turned out, wives, that would not leave him intermixed with the Canaanites. Jacob was what you might call a piece of work. He was a very unlikely candidate to receive the blessings of God, even as all of us are unlikely candidates to receive the blessings of God. And yet the blessings of God were exactly what Jacob received. It was, in fact, through the marital misadventures of this trickster that God first began to give a glimmer of the great nation he had promised Abraham. Yet the promise wasn't out of the woods yet. Jacob, now with four non-Canaanite wives, 11 sons, Benjamin hadn't been born yet, and a daughter, was not in the land. So God saw to it that Jacob got so sick of the double dealing of his father-in-law Laban that he decided to head back to Canaan. But when he did, he was faced with the news that his brother was coming to meet him. And let's see, we have skipped down to chapter 33. And so when he got back to the land, he was faced with the news that his brother was coming to meet him with a contingent of men large enough, more than sufficient, to wipe out Jacob and all of his children. 400 men was a significant force in that day and in this day. If 400 men were coming at you with hostile intent, I think the bravest of us, among which I certainly do not number myself, would be very frightened. If four men were coming to get me, four men of war, I would be intimidated. In fact, if one man with the reputation of Esau was after me, that would be enough to have me frightened, I can assure you. And it had Jacob frightened, as the story makes clear. Once again, God worked a miracle. And Jacob, now after a number of interventions of God in his life, a broken yet bettered man who had received the name of Israel, was spared. Instead of killing him, Esau embraced him, and one danger to the promise was averted. And yet another danger swiftly loomed. Dinah, Jacob's only daughter, was raped by a prince from a nearby city. And in order to, quote, fix what he had done, he sent his father, that is, the prince that had raped Dinah, sent his father off to Jacob with an offer of marriage, and indeed a permanent alliance with the inhabitants of Shechem. As the words of the prince and his father to their own people clearly indicate, the end result of that plan, and we're in chapter 34 now, the end result of that plan would be that Jacob and his family would cease to carry on the line of Abraham and would become just another family in Shechem. That would invalidate God's promises to Abraham. Just as God had used the trickery of Jacob and the hatred of Esau to see to it that Jacob didn't intermarry with the people of the land, even though God opposed, and indeed it's clear from the point of view of the narrator, which is God's point of view in the book of Genesis, that the trickery of Jacob was despicable and the hatred of Esau was inexcusable, God still used those two to see his promises come to fulfillment. And God used the trickery and hatred of Levi and Simeon to see that it didn't happen in the next generation either, to see that the promises didn't pass away in the next generation. After deceiving the men of Shechem into undergoing circumcision, they wiped the city out when they were too weak to defend themselves. And it's not a pretty story. And Levi and Simeon come across in a not-so-pretty light. Indeed, it's this deed by Levi and Simeon that led, ultimately, to the Levites not having an inheritance of their own in the land, but being scattered throughout the land. So, and the same happened to Simeon. So there were consequences for their deed, and yet, even as we're going through the story, God used their deed, of which he did not approve, to bring about an end of which he did approve, namely the fulfilling of his promises to Abraham. And that's why this story is in here, because here is an obstacle, and indeed this is one of the things that's going on, and I don't want to get ahead of myself too much, is that if you notice, the obstacles to the fulfillment of God's promises were not all out there. They weren't just that they struggled to have children. They were also inside the people of God in that they did all kinds of despicable things, and yet God still was faithful to his promises despite their unfaithfulness to his covenant. And that is something that the children of Israel, who were very unfaithful to God's covenant, as it turns out, they needed to hear that even when you're unfaithful, God remains faithful. And even when you fail, God even takes your failure and turns it to fulfill his promises. And that's not something that God's people then needed to know only, but something God's people today need to hear as well. Chapter 36 tells, this in itself posed a danger to the promise. So even though God worked through their wickedness to fulfill his promise so that they would not be intermingled with the nations, yet that had the consequence that now the children of Israel were in danger from all the nations that were around them that here are these people who are doing these outrageous things. Let's wipe them out before they do anything else outrageous. And that was Jacob's response to Levi and Simeon. You've made us to stink. We're going to get wiped out. And yet God protected them even from this by placing the terror of God on the cities round about them. And God came to Jacob and reminded him in chapter 35 of the promises that had been made of worshiping God back when he was running from Esau. And when Jacob obeyed, God reiterated his promises once again. Chapter 36 tells what happened to the family of Esau. Because of his connection with Abraham, Esau would receive blessings, and yet Esau and his seed were not to receive the promise that God had given Abraham all the way back in chapter 12. Because, as God had told Rebekah, the promised line was to be to the descendants of Jacob. The story now shifts in chapter 37 to one of the sons of Jacob, now known as Israel for good. He was named Israel, and then he was still called Jacob, and then he was named Israel again. And then after that point, he becomes called Israel in the story. Israel, who apparently didn't learn from the disaster that the favoritism of his parents had brought into their family, decided to play favorites with his own sons with predictable consequences. Joseph was sold into slavery by his own brothers, an action in which Judah took the lead. So selling Joseph into slavery was Judah's idea. All the other brothers, including Reuben, who wanted to be better than they were, they all worked together to conceal what had happened. Chapter 38. The story now shifts back to the sordid tale of Judah, who demonstrates himself to be both immoral and self-righteous, a hypocrite and a deceiver of the first order. And yet for all that, and here's how the story functions in the overall narrative, because there's something going on when we get to the end I'm going to point to. By the end of the story, this sordid trickster is publicly admitting guilt, demonstrating the first glimmers of transformation. So whereas before he had covered his sin and accused others, at the end he is accusing himself and saying to Tamar, "You are more righteous than I am. What I've done is wrong." That's at the end of chapter 38. And Judah is going to show up again in a different and a changed light. God is doing a work in Judah, and that's significant for a particular reason that we'll get to at the very end of our lesson, which hopefully is approaching soon. The story now shifts back in 39 to Joseph and how he remained faithful against the greatest of odds. By the end of 41, Joseph has become the second in command in Egypt, and through his wisdom, not just the nation of Egypt, but all of the peoples of the nation around are receiving blessing. And we'll return to that. Of course, the peoples around include his own family, starving back in Canaan. Chapters 42 through 45 tell, first and foremost, the story of how Joseph made himself known to the brothers that had once hated him, and how he used his newfound position to preserve the family of promise, now expanded, against the famine that threatened to snuff them out. And yet Joseph is not the only main character in this section of chapters 42 through 45. Judah, who had shown himself such a scoundrel in 37 and 38, also shows up again. And the Judah of chapters 43 through 45 is not the Judah of 37 through 38. His character, once self-serving and hypocritical, has become self-sacrificial to the point that he was willing to spend his own life in slavery if it meant that Benjamin could go free and his father could be spared further grief. That's a transformation of character, if I've ever heard of one. Chapters 46 through 48 tell the story of how Israel and his family make the trip to Egypt, but only after being assured by God, even as Abraham had all those years before, that this sojourn in Egypt was part of God's plan to make of them a great nation and to bring them back to the land of Canaan, just as he had promised them all along. Chapter 49 records the blessings of Jacob upon his son, not just upon the firstborn, but on all of them. So whereas before it had been the firstborn or one particular son that had received a blessing, now in chapter 49, all the sons receive a blessing. But there's one blessing in particular that becomes important for the story going forward, and that starts in verse 8. "Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. Binding his foal unto the vine, and his ass's colt unto the choice vine, he washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes shall be red with wine, and his teeth white with milk." The promise was still somewhat cryptic, even as it had been in Genesis 3:15 and 12, 1 through 3, but it was by no means dead, that there was going to be a particular seed. It was cryptic at this time. No one could have understood it, but we looking back can see there's a developing promise of a particular seed that is going to have a regal function that is going to restore everything that Adam had destroyed. And that promise was given to Judah, and that's why the story of the transformation of Judah's character, so much time is spent on that, because of this promise to Judah here. And that's why it becomes important that his character was transformed, because he is going to be the one through whom the promises are going to be fulfilled, and so it's important that he is able to accomplish that role. Even though the descendants of Abraham led crazy mixed-up lives, lives that both constituted, so their own lives were obstacles, and they encountered obstacles, every kind of obstacle to the fulfillment of God's promises that you could possibly imagine, and yet God still kept his word, and over and over and over again, God repeated and reiterated and even expanded his promises. There are two things that drive the stories that come together to form the overall narrative of Genesis. The first, as I've mentioned, is the threefold promise of a seed a land and a covenant relationship with God that God had given to Abraham and then reiterated to the patriarchs. No matter how sinful or foolish Abraham's descendants were, and no matter how impossible their circumstances seemed, God always found a way to keep his word to them. The second thing driving the narrative is the twofold command to go to the land of promise and to be a blessing. So go and be, that twofold command that we noticed back in Genesis chapter 12. And what is so significant about the story of Joseph is that Joseph, more than any of the other patriarchs, more even than Abraham himself, succeeded in blessing the nations that surrounded him through the wisdom that his relationship with God gave him. So that's why Joseph is so significant to the overall story, is because Joseph is the one that is being a blessing to the nations. This was what they were all supposed to be doing and often signally failing at accomplishing. And even though the promised seed would not ultimately come through Joseph, through Joseph, the world could get a glimpse, imperfect though it was, of what the point of the whole endeavor was from the beginning. So remember, I talked about four promises. One of them is under the surface. That promise under the surface is why so much attention is paid to Joseph, because that was why the three promises were given, so that they could be a blessing to the world and reverse the curse, and you could see how that was going to take place, and Joseph gave an advanced picture of what that would look like. Yet even while the story of Joseph is developed, the development of Judah's character and the promises made to him reminded the children of Israel back then. So even while Joseph is kind of giving an advanced preview, this is what you're supposed to be doing, the promises to Judah and the attention paid to Judah is at the same time pointing in the direction that Joseph is only a picture. The promise is so much greater than this particular picture of what it might look like. So Joseph reminded the children of Israel back then, even as they do us today, Joseph was in the end only a somewhat foggy and imperfect sneak peek of the true fulfillment of the promises that lay in the future, just how distant of a future no one at the time could say. In these weeks that I've had so much of the story to cover, I've not been able to give as much application of our stories as I would like. There are a few things I cannot forbear to mention. First of all, the stories of the patriarchs remind us that God's promises and purposes for his people are always tied to his plans and his purposes for his creation as a whole. It is never about us. It always involves us. It's not about us. God's love is directed to us. It's not to be kept. It does not end with God's love comes to us. It does not end with us. It is always first about God and second about God's good plans for his creation as a whole. God is concerned for us as individually, certainly, and I would never want to deny or downplay that at all. But I do think we should be getting the sense by this point in the story that God's plans are always bigger than ours. God's agenda is always bigger than the building of our own individual little kingdoms. Abraham would have been happy with just having a son and some cattle. That would have satisfied all of Abraham's desires. And yet God kept giving him promises, the end of which was the redemption of the world and the reversal of the great rebellion and all the consequences it had brought in his wake. And Abraham was like, just give me a son already, God. I don't care about all your promises. And the story of Abraham is how God brought Abraham to the point where Abraham cared as much about the promises of God as he did about the son that God had given him. So he cared about what God was promising him, not just what he actually wanted in his own little world. So that's important for us to remember. Second, the patriarchs themselves posed almost as many or indeed more obstacles to the fulfillment of God's promises as their circumstances ever did. God uses crazy mixed up people. Just because God is using someone doesn't mean that God is approving of all that they are doing. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, no matter what happened, no matter how bad they messed up, no matter how overwhelming the opposition was that they faced, God was faithful to his promises to them. This was the point that Moses was making to the children of Israel in the wilderness. They needed to know that the God who had made so many promises to them in the present against seemingly impossible odds had already kept his promises in the past against equally impossible odds. We need to know that too. If the story you are telling has you at the center, you need to realize that God's story doesn't have you at the center. If you think that just because God is using you or someone else, then you or they must be okay with God, you are very sadly mistaken. God uses all kinds of broken people, which is wonderful news until and unless you try to use that news to deny your own brokenness. Yet most importantly, if you think that somehow God is going to renege on his promises to you, that somehow the circumstances that have shown up in your life are so bad that God can no longer be faithful, or the character that you have demonstrated is so poor that God will no longer be faithful to you and will cast you aside, you need to rethink the role that God is playing in your story, because that's not the role that he plays in the stories of the patriarchs, and it's not the role that he plays in his story as a whole. We've now come to the end of the book of Genesis, a book which is so foundational for the Bible's big story as a whole, which is why, after the introduction, we spent 4 weeks in Genesis. When we meet again in 3 weeks, Lord willing, we will be attempting to cover the entirety of the remainder of the Pentateuch, so we will see how that goes. And you might want to be in prayer for that, or at least bring a seatbelt, because we will be flying, Lord willing. So that may end up getting split into 2 weeks. We'll see how that goes. But thank you all. Are there any questions or comments before we conclude?